Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
Welcome to Present Company, the Netflix podcast that brings you dynamic conversations with exceptional people behind your favorite series, films, documentaries, and specials. I'm your host, Krista Smith. For years, I was Vanity Fair's ambassador to Hollywood, interviewing countless actors as well as creatives and authorities across the spectrum. My passion is talent, any form of it. How do you know you have it? How do you cultivate it? How do you protect it? And also, I want to get to the heart of what drives it. On this podcast, I'll be talking to people in Hollywood and far beyond. Thank you for joining me. Today, I'm talking to one of my favorite people, Whitney Cummings. Writer, director, producer, actress, stand-up comedian, published author, and animal activist. And she now has her own podcast, Good For You. Actually, that's the name of the podcast, Good For You. Not Good For You, Whitney, but Good For You, Whitney. Whitney was still in her 20s when she had two shows on network television. One she was the star of, and it was called Whitney, which ran for two seasons. In the other, Two Broke Girls, she co-created with Michael Patrick King, and that ran for six seasons and is in syndication. She's got razor-sharp business instincts, Ivy League smarts, and an insane work ethic, and a fearless comedic style. So settle in, because there's lots to learn in this one. This is Whitney Cummings. Oh, my God. Whitney Cummings in the house. So proof of life here. I know we are both live technically in L.A. County, but did you like take an airplane to get here?
I moved like 10 miles away and everybody thinks that I like need a passport to come into town.
I know, but it feels like
I know it's far. I live out in the woods because I don't do well with noise creatively, I realized. And I had a house and I was going to an office to work, which I think psychologically is just like for creative types. But I just decided I wanted to go into the woods so that I could focus more.
And do you focus more?
I do. I get so much more work done now. And I just think in general, I think artists, we need to be in nature. We need to be in near the dirt. Mm-hmm. It's my new thing. I'm a crazy Topanga lady now.
Oh, my God. A lot of crystals
on the coffee table. That's right, draw the line. No bullshit crystals. I like being out in the woods. I like being out in the woods.
That's interesting. I like it. And you like all the animals.
I like all the animals. I like the solitude. I like the focus. And I got a place that was big enough to be able to build a podcast studio in my house.
So. I know, which is kind of remarkable. Yeah. So. And it's one of those things where you decided to do a podcast.
Yeah.
And I remember running into you and you're like, I'm going to do a podcast.
Yeah. And I probably said it much more begrudgingly than that. Because now as a comedian, having a podcast is just like having a website at this point. It's not really optional. So I felt this was not a consensual podcast. Time's up on podcasts. But yeah, it feels like pretty necessary now, I think.
Yeah, and you've had crazy success right out of the bat with it.
It's weird. I mean, I think that the key to any success now, I think, in our business is just being able to surrender when you have a really strong skill in one area of the business that is no longer necessary, that has become obsolete right away. You know, so it's like just when I really figured out how to make television, the TV business kind of completely changed. Just when I figured out how to make movies, the movie business kind of disappeared. So now I'm finally just like, because I'm the person that was like so reluctant to like get on Snapchat, to get on Instagram. I'm the person that's like, this is never going to catch on. I mean, I remember arguing with someone about Twitter, being like, this is never going to catch on. This is ridiculous. So now I'm finally just like maybe overcompensating the other way. When it looks like, you know, the business is going in a certain direction, I just like jump on the horse and don't ask questions.
And why do you think podcasts work so well with comedians?
I think they work so well with comedians because we're used to talking. We're naturally kind of engaging, off-the-cuff funny. But I think more than anything, it's because people are used to seeing us being really funny and gregarious. And when we do podcasts, sometimes you see the sad, dark, vulnerable, you know, side of us. And that's surprising. I think that the thing everyone's looking for right now is surprise. And feeling like they are witnessing or participating in or engaging with something that is real and that is surprising and that you can't find anywhere else. And I think that, you know, Marc Maron really kind of was the first person to be a comedian who then talked about, I have depression, I have anger issues, and I have, you know, and he was being vulnerable. And I think a lot of people are just interested in the sort of secret life of comedians offstage. Mm-hmm. And just sort of our ability to be sometimes self-destructively so forthcoming about our mistakes and shortcomings.
Well, you once told me that there's nothing more scary than a comedian who gives no fucks.
I said that? It's a scary... Yeah. Hashtag Monique. Mm-hmm. Yeah. but I think comedians, because we're so quick to overshare, is probably what makes us compelling.
Well, talk about overshare.
We have no boundaries whatsoever.
I listen to your podcast and I blush.
Uh-oh.
Like you talk about everything.
Yeah.
And I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Like there's no.
I black out, so I don't remember anything that I say. I don't think about it. I forget we're rolling. I can't believe I haven't been canceled. I mean, a comedian talking for 2 hours, it's like something is going to go wrong. You're bound to say something you're not allowed to say anymore. But look, I mean, I think that people now have a higher expectation for what you're going to share and how much you're going to share. The days of like being an enigma are over. The days of like having secrets are over. Mm-hmm. People expect to know everything about you and the intimate details of your life and psyche. And if you're not doing it, someone else is gonna. So you're going to play ball or you're not going to play ball.
Oh, my God. I know all the like the dick talk, the porn talk. Mm-hmm. You just got to go in there. Right.
I mean, comedians getting, you know, talking for 2 hours, it's always bound to go there at some point. But I'm trying to have a really diverse array of guests where it doesn't always necessarily go in that direction. But I'm still figuring out what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm not as experienced a podcaster as you yet. But I do think that, you know, people, especially comedy fans, want what Joey Diaz calls the wiretap. Like people just want to hear people talking. They don't want to hear it edited. They, you know, are doing their laundry. They're driving around. They kind of just want to hear an authentic conversation that doesn't, you know, it took me a minute to figure out, like, because I come from TV and movies where you make everything perfect and you rewrite for 6 months and you do the goldenrod pages and the salmon pages and you're reshooting and you're rewriting and you're in the, you know, still tweaking in post and you get to make everything better with music at the end. Like with podcasting, it's just, you know, for me, sometimes I'm like, how do people not think this is boring? Like, isn't this boring? Mm-hmm. But I think that people, it's just a new art that I'm not used to yet.
It's like a community around it. All right. I want to talk to you about your Netflix special, Can I Touch It? I loved it.
Oh, thanks.
And I want to know where your robot is.
Thanks.
It's frightening.
I am her.
That was a fright.
She's right here. You're talking to her.
Very, very impressive. But for a show like that, how much do you – obviously, you workshop it. I know you have an insane work ethic. You go out. You do the shows. You figure out what works. But how long does it take to prep a special?
Ugh, that one took forever. You know, I think it's actually getting harder and harder because there's so many late night shows now and there's so many great comedians on YouTube, on Instagram. You know, it used to be like if you had a premise, if you wanted to talk about, crystal water bottles, since we talked about crystal, you know, by the time you write a joke about it and tour with it for 6 months, Jimmy Fallon could have done it and Samantha Bee could have done it and Trevor Noah could have done it. And, you know, there's so many Twitter could have done it. Someone on, you know, Facebook or Instagram, a meme could have done it. You know, there's so much comedy out there right now that you have to be more specific. And if you don't get something on television before someone else does, you got to kill a joke. So because I was talking so much about what was going on with sexual harassment and stuff, I had like an hour, and then someone else goes and does a version of it, and then you have to cut 10 minutes, you know, because I don't want anything to be like what anyone else is talking about. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think your work has to be more and more specific now and more something that no one else would think to do. And then I wanted to do something really, really memorable. I mean, I think just saying jokes for an hour, like, I think those days are going to be over very soon. And the next generation wants something bigger. They want something louder. They're watching, you know, prank shows. They're watching Impractical Jokers. They see incredible Photoshop. They see incredible animation. Like, you know, comedians, we just really have to, like, step up in terms of big ideas of how to make our specials, like, special. So I started writing jokes about sex robots, and I got so obsessed with them, and I got so obsessed with getting the argument right, because we're also in this crazy feedback culture where now people get to tell you that what you've done is problematic. It's just, you know, so I think talking about something like sex robots was such a tricky territory to go into that I really wanted to make sure I was, like, you know, checking every box and covering my bases so that nobody could, like, come for me. So I went down to the sex robot factory to really do a bunch of research to make sure that I wasn't, like, you know, pro incel or something. Mm-hmm. Like, I was just like, there's, you know, because jokes aren't jokes anymore. Everyone thinks that, like, we're actually, you know, impacting people's choices, which is not what comedians do at all. Like, we do not have that power, and it's crazy that people are trying to give it to us now. But so I went down to the robot factory, and as soon as they said that they could make a robot that looked like me, I was just like, here we go. And I think that with comedy now, you know, I think Jordan Peele has changed comedy a little bit, and it's evolving, you know. It just really, when I was sitting in the movie theater watching Us, and people were laughing, but they were also horrified and gasping, I was like, shit, that's the new way that comedy is going. And when I brought her out on stage for the first time in La Jolla, the audience gasped and laughed nervously. And some people were screaming, some people were uncomfortable. And I was like, that's the next level for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I know how to get laughs. I know how to get applause breaks. Like, I want that thing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And how are you feeling about the whole PC culture?
This is going to sound dismissive and probably surprising. I don't think it's real. It's very small. You know, comedians, we know that this is like a couple thousand people. You know, I was in the Twitter offices, and they were telling us that there are 22% of Americans are on Twitter. Of that, 2% generate 80% of the comments.
Wow.
It feels bigger than it is. You know, I definitely think that there's a lot of progress to be made. There's a lot of words we should not say. I totally agree. But this, like, idea that there's, like, a PC frenzy and that comedians can't make certain jokes, most of America does not feel that way at all. Most of America just wants to go to a comedy club and for someone to make them laugh is kind of at all costs. And they know that what comics say are jokes. Like, America still understands. Like, a comedian might say something they don't believe, or they might just be trying to get a reaction. Like, that's what they do. Comedians are not politicians. We're not, you know, humanitarian. That's not what we're signing up to do. And I think America understands that. But I think that what's going on right now in this PC culture moment, cancer, I mean, I think it's very much about the president and not really about comedians. And if that changes, I think it'll kind of go away. But what people don't understand they're doing is that comedy comes from things that are taboo and things that are off limits. And what PC culture is doing is just making more things off limits. So it's really just helping comedians. It's really doing the exact opposite of what you think you're doing. When you try to silence comedians, you just make us funnier. You know, but it's helping comedy. It's kind of backfiring on the fake justice warriors, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. The more taboo you make a word, the more comedians are going to want to say it. And the more they're going to make fun of you guys. You're just giving us more shit to make fun of.
And you've dealt with a lot. I feel like from an observational perch that I had.
Yeah.
You had so much success kind of so young. Mm-hmm. In terms of your show and your, I mean, obviously it was the roasts. I think that's how you came up,
on the
Comedy Central roast. Yes. And then you were on Chelsea's show.
Right.
And that's when I first remember seeing you and be like, oh my God, that girl's so funny. I love Chelsea's show. I watch that all the time, right?
Yeah.
I loved that kind of format. So I was into that. And that's when I first discovered you. Yeah. And then you had your own show.
Right.
And then you did something else with like a talk show, and then you were doing a thing with Michael Patrick King and Two Broke Girls. And I feel like your success brought on a disproportionate amount of schadenfreude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah, maybe. You know, I think, you know, the most interesting, I think, part of that was I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I was making multicams. And I think anyone listening to this show, you know, will have an understanding of what that means. But it's essentially I was making shows that were kind of out of vogue in a way, not with America, but with Hollywood. And multicam is a Seinfeld or Mad About You or Friends, something that has a live studio.
Traditional,
you know, which it's so funny that people, you know, and the shows when they came on, it was The Office was on, 30 Rock was on, you know, single camera NBC shows were very in vogue right now. Parks and Rec being understated, being super dry and subtle, you know, was kind of the trend in like hipster comedy. But, you know, me and Michael and then the show I did for NBC was very much a traditional, you know, multi-camera show. And people had this like a weird thorn in their side. And they were like oddly nettled by the idea of someone in an audience or, you know, people kept saying like, was that a laugh track? Like all of a sudden there was a lot of cynicism around multicams, even though that's what we all grew up on. And reruns of Seinfeld and Friends were still the top rated shows, you know, and Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men and not Mike and Molly. There was one other.
How I Met Your Mother.
How I Met Your Mother. These were all the top rated shows. So there was a little bit of a dissonance. There was like an incongruence, you know, between America and Hollywood. You know, America was watching multicams, but critics in Hollywood were having like a backlash against them. And the biggest shows the kids were watching were Disney multicams, the Wizards of Waverly Place and Zack and Cody. You know, there's this whole next generation that wants to watch multicams as well. So I think that one of the constant struggles for any definitely comedian, but writer is always like, am I going to appease Hollywood critics or am I going to be mainstream and get actual numbers and make something that people are actually going to watch? Because it's very rare that something is both mainstream popular and critically popular. And for me, as a comedian, it was just like a no-brainer. Like, yeah, I'm going to make a multicam with another comedian, Chris D'Elia, and do it in front of an audience. And, you know, America liked it, but, you know, Hollywood people were sort of like, this is so loud and trying too hard. You know, it's like, but I also think that was maybe one of the last ad campaigns that was really like ubiquitous in a way that you could be, you can't be ubiquitous anymore because there's, you know, social media has made marketing so stratified. You know, I mean, there's shows that are hit shows that I've like never heard of. I'm just like, I didn't know this was a show. How are other people finding out about it? How are 10 million people? Like, I've never heard of it. You know, some things just won't get to us anymore because of the algorithm. But it used to be we would look at like billboards. Everyone would see the same billboard and there'd be like, we would know what shows were on. You know, there was some award show nomination that just came out and I looked at the contenders and I didn't even know a couple of the shows. I was like, how could I not know a show that's on? So that was one of the last, I feel like, ubiquitous ad campaigns that I think, you know, at a time where TV was starting to change and less people were watching television in general, especially NBC at the time, you know, there was just an attrition. Netflix was kind of just starting. And I think that it was an ad campaign that was like sort of the last ditch effort to get people to watch a network TV show. And I also, the show tested really highly. That's the other thing that, you know, I test well, guys, believe it or not. Who knew? So I think that there was this crazy ad campaign. And, you know, the more you see someone sort of,
the more you hate them, right?
The more you hate, you know, it's just sort of this thing of like, why is she trying so hard? It's like, I didn't make those billboards. Like, I didn't put them up.
How did you handle that? Because I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but
no,
it's been long enough that you have perspective on it.
Yeah.
And to go through that, to create this thing, to have that success, to be anointed, at least to have that opportunity as like a, you're still in your 20s.
Yeah.
I mean, like you're just like basically.
I was like 27. Yeah. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And I didn't know how to hire people at that point. You know, like there's this great writer, Eric Zicklin. He was on Frasier. He's been on a bunch of stuff. And he said he was just like, when comedians get TV shows, like he's like, it always blows my mind because it's like saying, hey, you're a really good comedian. Now run a 7-Eleven. Like, that's what it is. I mean, you're running a 7-Eleven when you're running a TV show. And it's like, I was a comedian. Like, I didn't know who to hire. And I just hired people that I thought were nice that I had good chemistry with. That's not how you're supposed to sort of do it. And I didn't know how to fire people. I didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings. You know, no one really tells you how to be a boss. Like, there's no, I know that in Hollywood, there's like some showrunner sort of like classes or something. Like, I never took any of those. I had no idea. So I think the big struggle with me for the first couple of years was just like realizing, like, oh, the way TV works, everyone that's writing on your show wants their own show. They're there because theirs didn't go. they've got some other development deal or they've got some other show that, like, it just didn't occur to me that there weren't writers that only work on your show.
Right.
Like, that's, like, I thought that was a thing. I thought, like, oh, they're all here to make your dream come true. No, they're just here because theirs didn't go and they're waiting. They're developing for next pilot season, their show. They want your job. Like, that was just, like, a 101 naive thing that I didn't understand. And also, this was back in the day. This actually is really interesting to me, where you would make 24 episodes in a row. That's kind of unheard of now. You know, I mean, now with I think part of the reason so many of the, you know, Netflix shows are so good and these HBO shows is that they make like 10. They have a year to make
eight of them.
Sometimes 8 to 10. That's, I mean, the English model, you know, you get to actually have time to make it good. We were doing the assembly line, Lucy with the glove on the, you know, like bottles coming down the line way faster than you can keep up with it. So also there was just, there's no way to make something consistently really high quality when you're doing 24 episodes in 26 weeks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's like, you know.
And do you tune out the noise?
I think so. I you don't know what you don't know, but I do remember being in the writer's room when I think it was the NBC show was happening and Two Broke Girls was happening concurrently, and I had to go to some like event, and I didn't even know about all the billboards. Like, I didn't even know about the ad campaign that was everywhere because I was working. Like, I didn't see it. I went from home. I went drove from a mile to the studio and then back, and then I drove over the hill my first time out since we were in the writer's room, and I saw a billboard, and I was like, oh, Jesus. And then I saw a bus with me on it, and I was like, oh, fuck. And then I saw, like, another billboard, and I was like, you guys, this is a lot of billboards. And I assumed that was, like, just in L.A., just, like, an ego thing. But it turns out I was, like, on popcorn bags. Like, it was just, like, it was just too much. Like, and then I went to this party, and people came up to me, and they were consoling me about something that I didn't know was happening. Everyone was like, you know, just hang in there. Just hang in there. They're just jealous. And I'm like, who's jealous? They're like, just don't. Just look, people didn't like Seinfeld the first year it was out. I'm like, what? What are you like? I was like, what is everybody talking about? And then I made the grave mistake of Googling myself. And I was like, oh, Jesus. You know, so but no, I get it. Look, if there was like a show called Lindsay with some girl named Lindsay, I wouldn't be making jokes about it, you know? I mean, I would just be like, Lindsay's here, guys. We've got to go watch Lindsay. I mean, like, it's ridiculous. Which, by the way, that was not the name of the show when I pitched it. Yeah. I think that at the time, they were just like throwing stuff at the wall because nothing was really working. And they were like, let's go back to this old school model where you name a show after a comedian.
Yeah.
And it really did, you know. And first of all, I will say 40 episodes of a television show, I totally see as a success. And I think it was time to end it for so many reasons, which, by the way, we're also getting a 1.8. That would have been a huge hit today.
Yeah.
Like, as like literally.
1.8 isn't 1.8 million viewers.
No, 1.8. I guess that's what is that mean? Five. That's like five something million. I mean, the, a hit show right now is getting a 0.8 and we were getting a 1.8. I mean, it's just everything, you know, I think it was, what else was on? The Office, Community, remember? I think we were paired with Community. And this was at a time where the TV ratings were just changing. And I don't think TV even knew yet that all the numbers were going down, you know? Remember, Mindy's show was on Fox, I think, the same time. And everyone was just getting lower and lower numbers. But people didn't realize it was just people leaving TV, not watching that show, you know? So I feel like TV, we're always the last to know what's going on.
Well, it's all changing. The podcast world will be changed by the time we're out of the door here.
Yeah, but that's so true. It's very true. But I think the podcast is going to be the next big. I mean, it already is, but is the thing.
So crazy.
The fact that we put, you know, $5 million an episode into a thing that takes 2 months to make and then it goes. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, this we can put out tomorrow. You know.
I know. It's and then you basically your show, monster success of Two Broke Girls, syndicated. Yeah. That's on somewhere every minute of every day.
My favorite
all
Two
over
Broke
the world.
Girls story is we went in, you know, the great Michael Patrick King, and we had this script written and it was ready to go. And we went in and a male network TV head said, love it. I want to make it. Can it be two boys? And there was a minute where we're like, two broke boy. Okay, I guess. Like, we actually thought about it. But then Nina Tassler, of course, the great Nina Tassler used to run CBS when it was the number one network. And she was like, I was a waitress till I was 28. Let's do it.
So great.
She got it. She was chewing gum in the meeting. I'm like, I'm with her. I'm following her. And she was so freaking smart about it. She didn't make us change anything. She really protected what we had written, even though it was really, I mean, we got a lot of crap when that show started casting because it was sort of like buzzy around town. But people were saying we said vagina in it too much. It was too dirty. Like there was a lot of kind of negativity around it. And then the table read, once we got Kat Dennings and got that table read and found Beth Bears, who was just like, you know, to play the blonde. I mean, we tested so many people. We auditioned, I mean, hundreds of people for that part. And Beth came out of nowhere. I think she had like one credit. She had done like she was like in a pageant in Seattle. Like it was,
oh, I love a pageant. I love a pageant.
And she came in and just killed it. And I remember Nina Tassler said at the table read after we did it, she said, Kat Dennings is going to be the highest testing person of pilot season, which for those of you listening, that just means like when they focus test it, she tests very highly. And that was it.
And she did, obviously.
That was it. Off the charts.
Right.
I think she tested higher than William Shatner did in whatever that my crap my dad says show.
Right.
Yeah.
Not Star Trek.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would imagine. But that was a big deal for a woman to test highly. It's hard because especially with like bitchy women, it's like, you know, it's easy not to like. This was before like being shrill and acerbic was kind of in. Mm-hmm. Before anyone wanted that.
Well, thank God Michael Patrick King has always loved that.
Always loves the dark corners of women's psyches.
Right. What did you learn working with him?
Oh, my God. Michael is, you know, as you know, did Sex and the City, which was like my religion for the longest time. And The Comeback, which is just so incredibly nuanced and complicated.
The Comeback needs to come back.
I mean, it's
everyone I talk to. I know. Talks about, references that show, references like it was ahead of its time. Oh, my God, that was my favorite show.
Yep.
They can go back and the specificity that people have around that show is incredible. Mm-hmm. Like they'll dissect a scene and remember that person was in it for
every observation that's currently being made about how women are judged and pulverized and subjugated and criticized unfairly in this business. Every one of those observations were made in The Comeback in a very deft way. I mean, there was, and then on The Comeback, there was that whole episode about if a woman doesn't wear makeup, an actress, she's called brave, you know, and mm-hmm. He did it so well. And him and Lisa are just like, it's so hard to make good television and find a great pairing of people, you know, the Larry David and the Seinfeld, the Lisa Kudrow and the Michael Patrick, you know, it's really all about, it's just as much about the idea and the writing as it is to the people you pair up with. Lightning just has to strike so many times, mm-hmm. you know, for something to go well. But Michael, his obsession with specificity, because there is a little bit of, oh, we'll find it when we get down there. You know, we'll find it when we get, we'll let the actresses, you know, he is like, you know, a perfectionist in a way that at first I was like, this is really detail oriented. And then I was like, no, this is just like what it takes. You know, Michael also protects his characters. He's so protective once he figures out what a character is. I remember, and he's so loyal he's so loyal to reality. Like he won't let anything move faster than it actually would in real life. His whole thing is like, what would really happen in real life? You know, which is in a weird way, not what I thought writing was. I was like, no, you have to make up what happens. And he's like, what would actually happen? And sometimes the best writing isn't your imagination. It's just playing out how it would actually go mm-hmm. in real life, if that makes any sense. He's all about grounding things. He's all about making it happen in a way that is incrementally honest. So I remember on the pilot, Kat Dennings and Beth Bears' character were sort of enemies in a way. They didn't get along. They were kind of like oil and water. But in real life, the actresses were becoming friends, obviously, you know, you know, they were not supposed to get along. It was supposed to be a very slow burn that they were going to start growing on each other. And at the last scene, we had this crane coming and they were walking away in the night down a street in Brooklyn. And Beth and Kat just kind of naturally grabbed each other's arms, you know, to like kind of walk down the street. Michael was like, no, that can't happen. Like that wouldn't happen that's happening with the actresses, but that's not happening with the characters. And I remember being like, what do you mean? It was kind of a cute thing. But he is so locked in to the reality of the characters. I think it's really easy when you're on set to get lost in the actors and the people and the moment and to forget that we're not here to all be friends and we're not here to, you know, have a rap party. We're here to tell the truth about how this would actually play out. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing with Michael. Everything's got to be earned. You know, nothing gets to happen just because we're on a TV set and we have it. Because the problem is that you turn to a magician when you're running a show. You can get any prop you want. You can get any person you want. You can shoot a thing. You can go get a horse. You can go get a, you know, costume whenever you want. But Michael is all about, you know, restraint and really like teasing things out. He's very, very patient in his storytelling. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because he's like, the longer we wait to do this thing, the more powerful it's going to be. When sometimes the instinct is, when you're insecure, is to just kind of like throw the kitchen sink of like, here's all the jokes. And, you know, he also is, you know, because Michael was a comedian. He was stand up, you know, so it's all about the laugh for him. When he's, it's not about his joke or his idea. It's about the best idea. And there are a lot of, you know, egos in our business. Spoiler alert. And Michael just has no ego. If something gets a laugh, it's in. Because you can't deny an involuntary response from people.
Right.
If something makes people laugh, it's in. Don't ask questions. You know, Michael knows when to overthink something, but also when to underthink something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just is what it is.
Did you take some of that when you went in to showrun for Roseanne? Were you able to take some of that with you?
You know what? I was. And that's a really interesting question because Roseanne was always so, so real. So real. And so grounded. And Roseanne was actually a pretty big inspiration for Two Broke Girls. You know, for me, I grew up on Roseanne and we were making a show about money or lack thereof and not having any. And I remember when we were making the sets of Two Broke Girls, we referenced Roseanne a lot. We really wanted to feel, you know, we didn't want to have a fake poor people, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even down to the costumes, like Kat Dennings' character had like 4 shirts and that was it. And she re-wore the same 4 shirts. She wouldn't have any more than that, right? She wore the same shoes for, I think it was the whole 6 years of the show, you know? Like, Michael is all about the reality. If these people are poor, they're poor. Why would she have these Gucci shoes? She would never own these, you know? Like, all those details matter to him. And I did bring that to Roseanne because, for me, the wardrobe, the set design of Roseanne, the makeup or lack thereof was such a big part of selling the reality of this family. And like, I always bought it. I always bought Roseanne. Big thing with Roseanne also is not being afraid of the silence, not being afraid of the pathos, not being afraid of the emotional moments. And Michael really, I really learned from him how to segue from a really big funny set piece to an emotional kind of profound moment.
I want to take it way back.
Should I start crying now?
Oh my God.
Sobbing.
Literally the body language. I wish the listeners could just see what happened in the room right now. So you grew up in DC and you've been very open about this. You grew up in a less than desirable environment in terms of what was going on in your home life. You didn't grow up with any kind of financial security.
Right.
But somehow, somewhere around 14 or so, you managed to get out of that situation mentally, basically, and retrack your life.
Right.
And you ended up at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, in Ivy League.
Without Rick Singer.
Mm-hmm. Without Varsity Blues. Without.
I didn't need Becky.
Yeah. You know, whatever it was on the water polo team. Which is kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
That, first of all, you would go there and that you, you know, very academic, very rigorous, very competitive, full of a lot of rich people.
Yeah.
And
Ivanka was there when I was there.
Was she?
Yeah. She was like walking around in her Jimmy Choo's. We were all in like Crocs and Uggs and looked like sea creatures. And I was like, who's that? There was that. She was going to Wharton.
I can't believe you just said Crocs. I know. I'm sorry. I blacked out.
Her high heels on cobblestone. Like, it was just like, this is a different species of person.
Did you interact with her at all?
Never. Never. I think I saw her like at a party once, but I didn't really party a lot in college. I was like, I like did 6 courses a semester and expedited and did it in 3 years because it was so expensive and I couldn't afford it. So
tell me a little bit about Whitney then.
You know, I was like any successful person. I definitely, I don't want this to seem like, you know, some kind of like sob story. Like, I have a very addictive personality, you know, and I get it honestly. I come from addictive personalities. I think I just figured out a way to become addicted to something sort of healthy or productive or something that would sort of ensure financial security. The addiction I got was like work. And I was never the smartest person in the class, but I was always the hardest working. And then I realized, like, if I just, you know, my work ethic actually stemmed from insecurity. I found myself as always, like, the slowest reader. I was the worst at math. And I was just like, I have to work 10 times harder than everyone. And once I got even to the skill that I was good at, I just sort of, like, kept that habit, you know? I think doing comedy, especially, like, you know, I think people think we just go out there and just, like, make it up as we go along or something. Is like, for every performance you see that looks spontaneous, there's, like, thousands of hours of preparation that goes in, you know, to it. And I never got anything easily. So I just developed the work ethic of, you know, trying twice as hard as everyone else. You know, because I come from sort of a hectic home, I know everyone does. Very quickly, I realized, like, the best way to survive in this home is to just kind of be perfect, like, get straight A's, you know, achieve highly, do well on your SATs. You know, we couldn't afford SAT tutors, so I had to sort of teach myself. You know, so it just, it when people say you have a good work ethic, I'm like, well, this is, I mean, it just doesn't occur to me that it's something, like, special or it's just not really a choice. It's just the only, I mean, I, you know, grew up watching a single mom and then I had two single aunts that I lived with for, I just always saw women working their asses off, you know? So that's like the only thing that I've ever really known. Mm-hmm.
And so when you're at Penn and you see Ivanka or Jimmy Choo's and I've been there, it looks a little like Hogwarts.
It does,
you know?
It does. It totally does.
It's got those cool towers and stuff.
Yeah.
And during that time, did you decide, oh my God, I'm going to take my Ivy League education and do stand up?
You know, I thought I was going to be a journalist. That was my dream in life. When I was in D.C., I interned at a local news station. And then I went to Annenberg when I was at Penn to study journalism. And I think that journalism and comedy are the same, are neighbors in the brain. It's observing, it's ferocious curiosity and kind of an obsession with justice. You know, I think comedians just need a little more attention maybe than journalists. Maybe they're just a little more immature. And I found myself really trying to learn the art of objective journalism, but I just am constitutionally incapable of being objective. Like, mm-hmm. I did this when I was an intern at NBC in DC, they offered, like, to read the prompter to get, like, a reel, like a demo reel that I could give an agent or something. So I put on a shirt from Express, my best shirt, and I was reading the local news from the teleprompter, and the story was, because, you know, local news is always so sensational and so dramatic, and so it was like something about, like, lead in your drinking water, and, you know, this little boy had been kidnapped, and I could not do it with a straight face. I was like, who would want to kidnap him? Like, what? Like, I just couldn't stop making jokes. Like, it was just, I realized stuff that is dark, my coping mechanism is to laugh. But stand-up still wasn't on the table. I came out to LA. I was really doing more hosting work. Like, I covered the coverage of the Sundance Festival for Sundance Channel. I used to be the host of the festival dailies on the Sundance Channel, which I can't believe we didn't, like, cross. I mean,
how did we not?
I was 23 and I was running around the Sundance Festival, like, interviewing, like, people making documentaries on, like, the Iraq War, and I was like, hey, so what's your shingle? Like, I was being such an asshole. Like, I don't know how I got that job. I was a correspondent for 2 years and then I became the host of it. So I was like, you know, I was like testing to be like an MTV VJ, like stuff like that. And then I went in to audition for Punk'd, which was that prank show at the time. And
Ashton Kutcher.
Yep. That's exactly right. It was like the secret season that he had gone on the news and said that he had canceled. And I ended up getting that job because in the audition, I didn't try to be funny. I played it like super straight. And then that was it. And there were so many comedians on that show that it was like, oh, I guess I'm, that's my, like, BJ Novak had been on it. And then I just started doing stand-up.
So when was your first time on stage as a comedian?
It was, I want to say it was like 2005 at a place called, so the great thing about LA for comedy is there's lots of rooms. You know, there's comedy clubs, but there's also lots of rooms. Like, there was a place called M Bar, bowling alleys. There was, remember Miyagi's? Mm-hmm. It's a sushi restaurant on Sunset. Used to have a stand. Like, there's stand-up rooms. If you go to any restaurant in LA, there's someone doing stand-up in a room next to it, you know? And so that was the first time I went. Natasha Leggero, I remember, was there. And Patton Oswalt was there. And the alt comedy scene in LA was just kind of really starting to hit with UCB coming in and stuff. So I more started, like, on the east side in little shithole rooms.
And was it that first laugh that you got in that shithole room that made you go, I want more of that?
It's so wild because I feel everyone's like, don't you get nervous on stage? I feel like, and this is going to sound corny, but when I went on stage for the first time, that's the first time I felt like normal. I was like, oh, this is it. This is the first time I'm not nervous. Like I had been nervous most of my life. And then when I go on stage, everything kind of clicks into place. I'm not saying that's healthy. I'm not saying I'm proud of this. I hate it as much as you do. But it just was like, oh, I mean, I spent my whole childhood performing for drunk people. Like it's a perfect, you know, way to recreate my childhood. Like it makes total sense. Like I spent my whole childhood being like, let's just keep laughing. Let's keep this positive. Like, you know, yeah, keep drinking. Let's make sure we don't fight, you know. That's all I did was like jazz hands as a kid, trying to make sure everything stayed copacetic. So it was like doing it, you know, for a bunch of people that actually were like there to laugh was like, oh, this is it. You know, but everyone told me to be a stand-up before I was a stand-up. Like, you know, it's you know, people's way of telling you to shut up, really. But I would like go on these like crazy stories and like, you know, and people would be like, you really should maybe try stand-up. Like, it's people's way of saying, like, please stop yelling at us with your opinions at dinner. And then the people I met, it was like, oh, you're my people. You know, there's also that, like, meeting other comedians and feeling like we were like instantly family and thought the same way and went to the same dark places and thought the same things. It's the first time I kind of just felt like normal, you know, and I was like, oh, I know how to do this.
And how is your relationship with money now?
You know, I don't think that's something you ever get right with. You know, I have like a scarcity complex. I've had lots of, you know, you never stop having come from financial duress. Like both of my parents had strokes without health insurance. Like I've had like crazy, you know, setbacks financially even after becoming solvent where you're just like, oh, whoa. You know, the first year that I made money, I didn't know how money worked and I couldn't afford to pay my taxes that year because I thought the amount of money you had in your bank account was the amount of money you had. No one told me, like, oh, no, at the end of the year, you have to give half of it. It was the first year I'd ever paid taxes because the first year I ever had enough money to.
Well, that's just fake money.
Yeah, no. And they were like, it's like, you don't, there's a lot of the money you have to give to someone at the end of the year.
Well, I think someone explained it to me as living in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, you actually get 11 cents on the dollar.
Whoa.
By the time it's agent, manager, lawyer, Uncle Sam.
Wild.
Publicist, if you have one.
Yeah, the whole deal.
11 cents on the dollar.
Social media manager.
Yeah, now.
Now.
It's probably 9 cents on the dollar, right?
Jesus. Yeah, you know, for me, like, I still live like I, you know, have not made money. It's just my constitution. I have a lot of fear around it. But I think comedians, like, I'm not the person that's like, comedians have to stay sick to be funny. But I do think, you know, I do end up giving money to family members, you know, and kind of living in that scarcity zone, because I think that's also where you end up being funny, getting too comfortable. I mean, comedians, like, we're funny because we're irritated and we're funny because we find flaws in things and we're funny because we're angry at shit. So usually money is sort of the I mean, I will like buy something, you know, online.
So like success is kryptonite then?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, it's there's no shortage of things that successful comedians will complain about. It's just it's like the more our problems get solved, the more we complain about how hard life is. But yeah, I mean, it's always a thing. And of course, as you know, I find other addictions, whether it's like animal rescue or whatever, we're all end up spending more money than I should on stuff and sort of recreating this stress cycle for myself so that I always have to keep working. But I also want to be in a situation where it's like, because you lose money in television now, you know, for the most part. So for me, I work really hard in touring and other things so that I can do my like side hustle, my mistress that is television, because it costs me money to do TV at this point, you know. So I like to work really hard so that I could kind of take a year off, you know, to make a TV show. You have to kind of, it's like having a kid at this point. You just like lose a year of your life to make TV.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's say you're driving down a dark highway, right? Like, right. Let's just say LA to Vegas, right?
Okay.
But it's like at night and there's not a lot of cars on the road, like 2 a.m.
Yeah. Okay. Uh-oh.
And you see like a wounded animal.
like a jackal?
No, maybe not a jackal. Maybe just a dog. Maybe like a stray dog.
Yeah.
Or maybe a jackal.
Yes.
And then you see like me with like a wounded.
You on the side of the road in 2 a.m.?
Me on the side of the road. I was biking for some reason. And you're like, and I just want to know. And like a semi's coming in the other direction. Who are you going to save first? You're going to save the jackal / dog.
How injured are you?
You know, I can't walk. I mean, I can maybe.
How old's the dog?
We don't know. It's dark. But the dog's cute.
But I know you. You're Krista. Are you Krista to me, or are you just some person?
Let's just say I'm just some person.
Okay. Well, that changes everything. Now it's that I'm a no-brainer.
No, but if it was me, it'd be a little bit harder.
I'm not. Yeah. See, it's just... look, I'm not a total psychopath when it comes to humans. I mean, the whole animal thing is just more like, you know, I was talking to the psychiatrist. I was making a movie about neurology, and he was saying that, you know, the area of the brain that is basically animal abuse and human abuse, it's kind of the same thing, because people always want to say, like, well, why do you love animals so much? What about saving people? It's the same thing. And this is kind of one of the only ways to show the next generation compassion for things that are, you know, have less power and things that are voiceless, is to show the next generation how to treat something that has less power. And I think it's, we're all scrambling right now of how to prioritize our time of like what to do right now with this kind of apocalypse, and, you know, how to, Me Too, and how do we help women in film, and how do we help with the diversity, and how it's like, for me, like, once I learned, you know, that combating animal abuse helps the next generation of children have more compassion, it was like, okay, that feels like something that is like a real impact on the largest number of people.
Do you feel it's been, I mean, you started young, you've been successful for a decade, right?
Yeah.
You've been in it.
Yeah.
So clearly there was a before and an after, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what's your take? I mean, you feel like, has your phone rung more because you're a female voice and, you know, people want to hire you for things, or they want your input, or?
I have, you know, it's such a complicated issue, and I can't speak sort of, you know, to the exact metrics yet. I just really try to just directly mentor people. So I like called my agency and I was like, bring me 3 projects from women or diverse writers that aren't getting made, and I'll help them get made. Like that I know how to do. I know how that can directly impact things, whereas I don't know how Twitter and Instagram and these photos of us all at award shows, I don't know what that's really affecting, how that's affecting change on a real level, you know. And I think I get frustrated when line producers aren't a part of the conversation, because, you know, it's not a very sexy title, line producers, who are basically the math dorks of any production. They're the ones that actually get the people hired. Those are the people we need to be engaging with. I'm definitely seeing a lot of different people tell stories who didn't get to tell stories 10 years ago. You know, I mean, the amount of attention that I got for my show coming out was crazy. I mean, it was too much. So much of it was sexist. I don't think the kind of, you know, attention I got back then would be tolerated today. That I can say for sure. I mean, in the reviews of the show I made, reviewers were talking about my body. They were saying I was skinny. They were, you know, calling me shrill. I mean, I was called shrill for real in a review. And now there's a show called Shrill. You know, I mean, that's how that is different. I don't think that people could get away with that anymore. I mean, there was a reporter for the New York Times Magazine who literally said to me on a call, I was 27 years old, and I made a joke about it, and he actually ended up getting fired over this, but he said, hey, I heard in the roast that you slept your way to where you are. Is that true? I mean, it was like crazy. You can't talk to people like that, you know? The thing that frustrates me that I'm seeing behind the scenes is like this, like, terror whenever there's a woman in the room, this kind of overcorrection of like, hey, do you need anything? Are you okay? I'm like, dude, I'm not going to sue you. I don't have time to sue you. Like, you're the least of my problems today. You know, I just don't want things to backfire so that everyone assumes that every woman is like made of glass and you can't talk to them or shake their hand or hug them or give them any criticism. You know,
well,
does that make sense?
It's been an interesting thing to watch, the pendulum swing, you know, swinging in both directions, and it needed to happen.
Yes.
And to me, it's unrecognizable from the city that I moved to.
Yeah.
20
years
ago.
Yeah, I bet.
Than how it is now.
It's just good business. And like when you hire women, like it's just good business. Like your business flows better. Things are more productive. Like I'm not running around hiring women because I like feel bad for them. It's selfish. They just do a really fucking good job, you know? And when you have diversity in your office, like the shows are better. It's just that simple. Shows are better when the room is not all white people. Mm-hmm. Like, just switch your brain from this being like you're doing everyone a big favor to it's actually selfish. Your show will just be better if you hire diverse people and women. Just make it more of a mercenary approach, you know, I think is probably more the way to go.
Do you think that I've noticed that comedians kind of have put their foot off the gas on this current administration and all the noise around it?
Yep.
That's blasting, you know, 3-4 times a day and 37 Twitters in a weekend all that stuff. Is there a reason for that? Is it just fatigue or comedy fatigue around it, or it's no longer funny, or
it's a little bit
it's emotionally
both.
Exhausting?
I think, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think comedy is all about surprise. Like, what's the most surprising thing you can do? What's the thing nobody's heard? And people talk about Trump all day, and there's a lot of really funny people tweeting about. By the time you get on stage at 8 o'clock at night, people have been on Twitter and they already know everything. They're already ahead of you. Like, and at this point, the most surprising thing to do and most refreshing thing to do is really not talk about him unless you have an angle that no one else has. And I think, I mean, the audience really tells you now, like, it's turning, it's a little bit of a jukebox mentality now. You know, I was at the comedy store recently and there was a comedian doing jokes about fat chicks. And this lady in the audience just went, "Can you stop?" I've never seen that before. I mean, that's new. It's new that people in the audience get to fast forward through your material. This is totally because of social media and podcasts, and people feel like they have a vote now. And they do, you know, if they like it, it gets in the algorithm. If they comment on it, you might comment back. And so I think that in terms of when someone goes on and brings up Trump, the audience just goes, you feel it in the audience. You just feel the like groan of people like, I came here to not hear about this. You know, I mean, John or it was Seth Meyers, you know, his Netflix special. He had that skip Trump jokes button. I mean, that was wild to me. The idea that he's like, I'm just going to give you an option in case you want to opt out of these, you know. But yes, I think that there's people are sort of running out of the bandwidth for it. And, you know, I just think people have heard everything and there's just sort of a cheapness about it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting to watch. All right. I have time for one more question.
I know.
Yeah, I know. What are you obsessed with that would surprise me or surprise listeners?
That's like, a really that's good like. Question. That's a good question. I'm obsessed. A lot of things I probably can't tell you about because it would be polarized. Make me like certain people's Instagram feeds, certain celebrities' crazy Instagram feeds. I probably can't share those. Like, I have a bunch of chains because comedians are monsters. So there's a couple famous comedians and I have these like chains where we make fun of people's Instagram feeds like all day, because it is wild to see some of your heroes just completely, you know, lose their minds on social media. I'm really into, you know, I'm working on something now. I'm really into robots. I know this sounds, you know, I obviously had to be for the last special. I totally immersed myself in it. But I'm working on the TV version of Super Sad True Love Story, the great Gary Steingart book that takes place in the future. And I've had to, like, learn a lot about, you know, what's going to happen in the future and what it's going to mean for us to basically live our lives essentially for public consumption, and the privacy stuff we've had to dig into. I mean, we essentially everything we have ever said and written is sort of going to be fair game soon enough. And I'm kind of into that. And I'm also just got really into my like ancestry. Have you done the 23andMe ancestry thing?
Not yet, because then it's Big Brother owns your DNA.
Oh, yes. Big Brother does own your DNA, but also this is what
I don't know if I have a relative that killed someone
that's it. They found the golden seed. Don't you want to know which one of your relatives probably killed someone in the 70s? Like, you know, everyone has that one uncle who has like a taupe bomber jacket that you're like, I feel like you could have drug a couple.
A little sus.
Yeah, super sus. But yeah, they found the Golden State Killer because one of his family members just took a 23andMe test. Like, you know, and I'm just fat. Comedians, like, we tend to move towards like really uncomfortable, polarizing areas. You know, being pro robot was actually like, I didn't even realize how incendiary a stance that was. I mean, that's a really raw nerve for people, especially as robots are taking jobs and as people are truly deeply afraid of robots, which I love learning the biological basis for fears like that, because essentially her fear of anything that is like a doll or like a, you know, scarecrow or a robot or something is called pathogen avoidance. It's our brain's way of making sure we don't procreate with something that could be sick or dead. Anything that looks human but doesn't quite move human, that's our sort of, you know, hippocampus, like very deep reptile brain's way of making sure that we don't. You know, like, I'm just obsessed with the biological basis of current sort of fears like that. So I've been digging a lot into what's going to happen in the future so that I can make that show. And then I want to do a show sort of about sort of my ancestors and the ancestral trauma we all inherit. And I found out that, you know, I have ancestors. I go back to Virginia, West Virginia, and Texas. So some shit went down. Some shit definitely went down in West Virginia and Texas. And I kind of want to make a show about that. So when I'm making a show about something, I really just like immerse myself into it in a way that's probably not particularly healthy. But that's it. I don't really have hobbies. I don't. You know me. Yeah. All I do is work, and I'm about to do, you know, 22 cities because, you know, the upside of what's going on with, you know, social media and sort of the collapse of movie and TV in a way is touring. It's huge. It's a huge, huge market right now, you know.
And you get to see the world, you know, you get to interact. And it's exhausting, but it's got to be so rewarding.
Well, it's nice to just see human beings that, you know, and to just that just want to laugh. You know, I think that we're in this echo chamber if we think that, like, no one wants us to say anything or behave. It's just not true. You know, we're letting very few people control a narrative. We're letting a couple haters change the course of comedy evolution, you know, and it really is dangerous that we're allowing people, just because they have a social media feed, to imply that comedians have some kind of control over people's behavior. And I no offense to all of us, but like, we don't have that much power, you know. But I think that because there's so much we're feeling really helpless about in terms of things we can't change right now, that comedians are like the easiest people to kind of go to.
Well, it's great to see you.
You too.
Good luck with the tour.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Thanks so much for joining me. Whitney's special, Can I Touch It?, is streaming now on Netflix. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you've been listening. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. Join me next time for more meaningful conversations here at Present Company.